Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why a Saudi-backed farm is getting a new water lease in La Paz County, and a retrospective documenting the work of a pioneering Chicano photographer in Tucson. But first, all eyes have been on one race for one seat in the state house of late. Republican candidate Michael Way has been in court defending himself against allegations that he broke the residency rules for state candidates. Way voted in North Carolina in 2021 and 2022, even though Arizona law requires a lawmaker to have been a resident here for at least 3 years when they run. Deborah Kirkland, a fellow Republican and precinct committee woman from the East Valley District, sued him over it. But a judge this week dismissed the claim on a technicality, saying the claim was filed too late. So he stays on the ballot. All of this is interesting enough, bringing up questions about residency in the courts and what it even means. But there's another layer to this political saga. Who's paying for this lawsuit and why it's a Republican trying to get Way kicked off the ballot? And that's where KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez comes in from our politics desk. Good morning there, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so it is a Republican precinct committee woman who brought this lawsuit to get Way off the ballot, even though it was unsuccessful. Why did she do that?
That's a great question, and it's the question that everybody wants answered. So Way is saying that the lawsuit is being paid for by far-right Freedom Caucus Republicans, which is a group in the state legislature run by State Senator Jake Hoffman, who also represents the Senate in the same district, which is LD 15. Mm-hmm. And so Way is saying that his political opponents are angry with him because in the primary election, he defeated a candidate who was a fellow Republican who Hoffman and the Freedom Caucus were backing. And so he's claiming that they're paying for this lawsuit against him. Now, when the woman, Deborah Kirkland, who filed and is the only plaintiff, went up on the stand and Way's attorney asked her who's paying for this lawsuit, she said, "I don't know." And he followed up with her and she was like, "Yeah, I don't know," which is an unusual response when asked who is paying for you to be filing a lawsuit against someone. Lasota, who is the attorney for Kirkland, said that the Freedom Caucus is not paying him, but wouldn't say anything else. And I believe Hoffman denied it to another publication, Hoffman denying that the Freedom Caucus is paying for the lawsuit. So it's a big question mark. There's a lot of speculation about who's paying for this.
Okay. So until the judge ruled that Way can stay on the ballot, this also had big implications for the Democrats, right? For who might control the state legislature going forward, because it's very narrow right now. The Republicans have a very narrow lead in both houses, but there's an election coming up and the Democrats are hoping to change that. This was, you know, potentially Republican on Republican sabotage in that way, right?
Yes. And I think their chances are just about done. But the Democrats fleetingly, I think, saw a potential opportunity for themselves in this very heavily conservative district. It's in the East Valley, think Queen Creek. And, you know, had Michael Way not been eligible, then there would have been a Democrat name on the ballot next to a Republican name who's ineligible. And, you know, there could have been potentially a write-in candidate or some other option, but there was a chance for Democrats to pick up a seat where they, you know, based on voter registration, shouldn't be able to.
Right. It's a very Republican district. Tell us more, Cameron, about the judge's decision here. This case seems pretty clear, right? Like, he voted in North Carolina just 2 years ago. State law says you have to have lived here for 3 years to run for office. What did this ruling say?
Well, Way says he feels like an Arizonan. And the ruling really isn't about the merits of whether or not he is an Arizonan or a North Carolinian or something else. Mm-hmm. It's about the timing. So there is a time frame in which you have to file a suit like this. And this one came too late. I believe the suit was filed in the middle of August. And Lasota's explanation for that was, well, you know, his client didn't know because Way lied about his residency, allegedly, and the client didn't know until reading about this whole situation in the Arizona Republic. Mm-hmm. And so it couldn't have been filed sooner. But the judge is like, well, you know, tough luck. You filed it too late. There's really nothing to be done here. Hands are tied. Lasota says he wants to appeal it, but Way's attorneys don't expect a different outcome.
Interesting. Okay. Is there any path that could lead to the legislature doing something differently here? Because the judge also sort of said, you know, now it's up to them.
Yes, a few different things would have to happen. The judge did, you know, stipulate that the legislature has the ultimate authority about what goes on over there, which is true. I mean, the legislature could hypothetically expel him. It really, I think, depends on if and when he makes it all the way to the ledge. It depends on who is in charge, because that general election that we're all gearing up for is not the last election. There still are leadership elections after that to decide who runs the chamber. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whichever party is in power gets to make those decisions. But if the Democrats get power, then, yeah, obviously, you know, Wei's not going to have a whole lot of power, whether or not they decide to kick him out or not. But if the Republicans win, it's kind of about which type of Republican wins, I think, because if you listen to Wei's version of events, the Freedom Caucus does not like him. So if they get power, maybe they would be more inclined to kick him out of the legislature versus the other kinds of Republicans, the non-Freedom Caucus Republicans, who maybe like him more and would be more inclined to let him stay and maybe even give him some power in the ledge.
Interesting. Okay. So let's back up for the last couple of minutes here, Cameron, and just talk about this idea of residency, right? Because this is not the only time we've seen residency questions brought up with lawmakers and end up in court. In fact, you ended up in court not long ago after trying to verify whether State Senator Wendy Rogers lived in her Flagstaff district or in another house here in the Valley. It seems like it's kind of a high bar to get someone kicked off the ballot because of these residency rules.
Higher and higher, because every residency challenge that has gone to court seems to fail. And, you know, this one is not about the merits. Like I said, it's about the timing. But it does seem to indicate, I think, to the people I've spoken with, that our residency laws are somewhat toothless because residency in the mind of the court anyway seems to be sort of a state of mind. So, you know, no evidence in a variety of cases seems to convince the courts one way or another about where someone lives.
A state of mind, like you said, Wei testified, I feel like an Arizonan.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Do people care about where their politicians live, Cameron? I think this is a little bit of an existential question, but in the last minute or so here, tell us what you think about it, having been through this and having covered the cases like this.
I think people care. I think people like to know that the person representing them and their community is also of their community. But I think that people don't think about it that much at the state legislative level, although it does raise eyebrows when people feel like they've been lied to. And I don't know if that's about residency so much as people feeling deceived and frustrated by deception.
Interesting. Okay. We will leave it there. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk. Cameron, thanks as always. Appreciate reporting here.
Thank you.
Fondamonte, a Saudi Arabian-backed farming company, has been under the microscope in Arizona in recent years since it came to light that it pumps untold amounts of Arizona groundwater to grow a thirsty crop, alfalfa, which is mostly shipped to the water-challenged Middle Eastern kingdom to feed cattle there. Our governor and attorney general have spoken out against the practice as Arizona faces an ongoing drought and an uncertain water future. And then last year, Governor Katie Hobbs announced her administration terminated state land leases for Fondamonte and Butler Valley, west of Phoenix. But not all of them. And now they've applied for a new well on its La Paz County property. And that's according to documents obtained by Arizona Public Media's Zachary Ziegler. And he's on the line now to tell us more about it. Good morning there, Zachary. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell us about this new well to begin with, where it is, how much water they might be able to pump with it.
Yeah, so as my news director, Christopher Conover, would say, a little birdie told me that I should ask about a well permit that they had filed. It turns out that Fondamonte had applied back in June to get a new well, and the permit went through in July. This is what is called a non-exempt well. It can pump about 3,000 gallons per minute, and the borehole for the well will go down between 1,000 and 1,500 feet.
That sounds like a lot, but how does that compare to, like, you know, what a pump might pump at somebody's house, for example?
Yeah, so there is a classification of wells that ADWR, the Arizona Department of Water Resources, has for wells that are more residential in nature. They're called non-exempt wells. Those pump about 35 gallons per minute, so like a tenth we're talking.
Wow, okay. You also spotted a hiring sign outside their building, so does it look like they are kind of growing their operation despite the fact that they have lost some of these state land leases, like we mentioned?
Yeah, and it's always possible that, you know, maybe it was just a summer hiring rush, but, you know, the leases that they lost total about 3,500 acres. Now, Fondamonte owns about 42,600 acres, and they still do have one lease on almost 3,100 acres that the governor and the attorney general really weren't able to do anything about, and that lease goes through 2031.
Right. So tell us why. Like, why are they able to get a new well lease now, even as the state has tried so hard to stop them from pumping water here? Why do they hold on to so many other leases around the state as well?
Well, we interviewed a number of people for our water podcast Tapped to talk about this very subject. And what we were basically told by a lot of water experts is it's the Wild West. Once you get out of the major metro areas or the active management areas, the irrigation on expansion areas in Arizona. So if you apply for a well and you meet all the requirements, the state really doesn't have a choice but to give it its blessing.
Interesting. Okay, so I want to back up now and talk a little bit about why Fondamonte has been so controversial and this long history that you've reported on extensively in the podcast you mentioned there about Arizona's relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is very interesting. How far does this go back?
It goes back to before the Civil War, before Saudi Arabia was really a thing, and back when Arizona was just a territory. This was the final spot where some of the camels from the U.S. Army Camel Brigade ended up. That was back, that ended up failing, actually, because it was an idea of a Secretary of War by the name of Jefferson Davis. So we can all assume where that one went once the Civil War started.
Wow, yeah.
And from there, it's gone into the University of Arizona. The first professor it hired was someone to help research the viability of date palms in Arizona. And that's why we have some date palm operations like in the Yuma area these days. And up where you all are in Phoenix, there actually used to be quite a few back in those days before California became the dominant date producer.
Right. So it's just in recent years that we've looked at this differently, kind of as drought and water have become more of an issue here in Arizona, it sounds like.
Yeah. There's been this relationship, but eventually as the Saudis started draining their wells back home, they were looking for a place to grow feed for their growing dairy industry. And there was this connection to Arizona that they were able to take advantage of because they knew a bit about agriculture here, because people were going over there to help them try and establish something similar.
Interesting. Do we know how much water they pump here that goes abroad?
We have no idea, really. The closest we can say is it is having some measurable impact. We heard from people from county supervisors to just locals in the area telling us, yeah, they've had problems with their wells. We heard about a church not too far north from Fondamonte from county supervisor Holly Irwin, who said their well has had problems. And we heard from others that their wells are getting kind of gunky because the water levels are going down and they're having to switch out their filters more often.
So there's no sort of, overview of this. There's nobody who's watching how much water is being pumped by various entities around the state so that we know we don't run out of groundwater?
No, and it gets to be a tricky thing. It's not quite like just a pool that's there and you can see, oh, is it full? Is it not?
Right.
Groundwater moves in a little different ways. And, you can look at the different monitoring wells in the area that ADWR has, and it can be a little hard. Maybe one shows, oh, water levels haven't really dropped, and then another one shows they've dropped 100 feet. It can be hard to predict exactly the effect it will have.
Mm. So, as you mentioned, you've spoken with people in La Paz County who are concerned about this. We heard from one on the show last week as well who's also concerned about another chunk of land that was bought up by a hedge fund. Their concerns are obviously with the water supply, with the well. What are the long-term concerns, though?
Yeah, and that was actually another story that we broke at AZPM about a hedge fund called Water Asset Management that bought land that, when we spoke to the person who runs the Wendon Domestic Water Improvement District, which is right where that land is, we were told basically that that's land that he said was leased by the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, to do something similar. And, he's seen a drawdown in action. But yeah, there are now hedge funds buying up land in the area. There's involvement from other foreign countries in the area looking to also grow alfalfa. So it's kind of a tense situation. And actually, on this week's episode of Tapped, we're going to dive into why it's been so tough to try and fix this at the legislature.
Right. That's my final question. So it would have to be some kind of policy change to change the way this all happens.
Yeah. And actually, we just last week spoke with the governor, and she said that something really has to be done at the legislation level to get this done. There are some possible administrative moves that she said she could make, but the big thing is there needs to be different laws on the books. That was kind of the consensus that we heard from a number of sources.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Arizona Public Media's Zachary Ziegler joining us. Thank you for coming on. Thanks for your reporting here. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look into a new exhibition at the University of Arizona, which features the work of a pioneering Chicano photographer.
He had become very involved in his identity as a Chicano, and he had decided that he wanted to capture ways of life that were quickly disappearing in the Tucson barrios. And, you know, so he literally went around with his camera, meeting people. He was fluent in Spanish. He wasn't capturing protest marches.
We'll hear about the everyday people who are featured in the exhibition. But first, it made national headlines when surprise mom Rebecca Massey was arrested at a city council meeting last month. She had been speaking against an agenda item to raise the salary of the city attorney when surprise mayor Skip Hall told her she was violating the rules for public comment and eventually asked an officer to escort her out. Here is edited audio of the incident.
Do you want to be escorted out of here?
You're violating my First Amendment rights.
Talking.
You are violating my First Amendment rights.
That's your opinion.
It's not a matter of opinion.
Do you want to be escorted out, Ms. Massey? Because that's what's going to happen. And it's going to happen in the future also. Anytime you attack
any staff member or any city
council.
That's why you change the rules.
This has been on the back of this form.
I understand, Mayor Hall, but that is completely unconstitutional.
Chief, could you have somebody come down here and escort Ms. Massey out?
Really, is that necessary?
Yes, I think
it is. In front of my 10-year-old daughter, you're going to escort me out for expressing my First Amendment rights.
She can go with you.
I'm not leaving. Do not put your hands on me.
Can you just step out with me?
Do not put your hands on me.
Come on out.
Okay, so I'll...
Hey, I have personal property.
Hold on.
You cannot contact me.
Yeah, I know. She can go out there. Okay, I'll entertain a motion to go into E-session.
Motion to go into E-session.
Second.
Then move to second it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're going into E-session.
Massey was later cited for trespassing and faces Class 1 misdemeanor charges for obstructing government operations and resisting arrest. Now she's filing a lawsuit along with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE, a free speech advocacy group, against the city, the mayor, and the officer who arrested her. They're specifically challenging the policy the mayor stopped her for, which doesn't allow for complaints about specific city employees during public comment periods. So we brought in a First Amendment expert to put it into context for us. Greg Leslie is the executive director of the First Amendment Clinic at ASU, and here is our conversation.
Well, it's funny because my first reaction is, yep, this is another example of First Amendment rights not being fully fleshed out when it comes to interacting with the government. Governments have a right to say nobody could speak at this hearing. But then once they say, yes, we'll have a public comment period, they can't discriminate based on your viewpoint or the content of your speech. So they create a limited public forum, and then they don't realize that they're limited in how they can regulate that. So we see these controversies fairly regularly around the country, you know, where legislators feel that or council members feel that they created that right so they can turn off the microphones anytime they want. And that's not true.
That's so interesting. So they could just not have it at all. But if they're going to have it, certain rules apply. What do you make of the rule that this particular case, this woman was accused of breaking, which is kind of like a ban on people talking in these meetings with complaints about specific employees or about specific members of the body? What do you make of that?
Well, it's funny because you always want to know what prompted a rule like that. Because with some city councils, it could be they got tired of people coming in and saying, When I waved at my garbage man this morning, he didn't wave back. So he should be fired, you know? And so you can see frustration building on something like that. But otherwise, I'm not sure why you would ban discussions of public employees. And in this context, particularly when that the person's salary was on the agenda as a matter to be discussed by that body, and you let her speak for 2 minutes and cut her off before she could speak for 3 minutes. It just doesn't make sense. Somebody just got an idea that, hey, we can stop her from talking, and no purpose was served by that. I think they should have let her go on.
So I think this gets at a broader idea here, which is about sort of what public comment is supposed to mean in local government in particular. Like, what is it supposed to be for? You said they don't even have to have it.
Right. And so I think that idea kind of permeates the public body that, oh, we're giving you this luxury just to appease you rather than we're letting the public comment on our work and taking that advice into consideration. So I think they have to almost have a commitment to say, we want to hear what the public says. We want to give the public a chance to speak about this legislation. But without that, it often just becomes, oh, we're doing this so we can say we're open.
Interesting.
And they don't really pay attention to a lot of the public comment.
So let's talk about some of the other ways in which these kind of public bodies, like city councils, but we've also seen examples of this at the state legislature, and how they deal with public comment, public testimony, et cetera. Like, I think about when a council will go into executive session, right? How does that apply to this broader idea of being transparent and allowing for free speech?
Yeah. Well, executive session laws or exemptions from the open meetings laws are meant to be very narrow when you're discussing things that can't be public, usually like legal advice. If you were public with the legal advice you were getting, then you would lose the privilege of keeping that confidential. So there's a certain obligation to keep legal advice confidential. And then other things could be, you know, if we discuss this, it'll affect our ability to get this contract signed or something. You know, if there's a very specific reason you have to keep something confidential, the law is very protective to make sure you can do that. But in every body I'm aware of, that executive session provision just becomes a wide open way to say, ah, we can't discuss this with the public, so we're going into executive session. And then it's impossible for the public to tell really what happened. And it should be that anything done in executive session has to be ratified in a public vote. But you don't see that a lot either.
Is that often challenged?
It's just so hard to win. I think people have given up on challenging it, frankly.
Those open meeting laws. So there's another example of this. There was a lot of discussion, some scrutiny last session at the state legislature about public testimony at committee meetings, right? And how long people were given to speak. It was often restricted to, you know, just a couple of minutes or, you know, selecting one person from a group to sort of represent the cause. What is supposed to be allowed there?
Yeah, it's hard to say again, because a legislature does not have to allow any public comment. Once they do, they've created a limited public forum, and they can't restrict it based on your viewpoint or the content of your message. But at the same time, you know, if they allow endless public comment, you know, it could just overtake the whole agenda.
Right.
You know, people wanting to speak for 2 minutes, well, if there are 80 people who want to do that, even that can be quite burdensome. So it's the idea in the First Amendment is that, you know, you've got to have reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions.
Okay.
So it's impossible to create a clear rule from that. You know, it's almost always context dependent. So will a court let a body get away with that? If there's a if there's an actual statute that says you have a right to speak before the legislature, and they say that we're only making reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions so that we can get everybody through here, then it's purely up to a court to say whether that's reasonable. But more likely than not, they'll say if you're trying your best to comply with the rule, but you have to put limits on it, courts will let public bodies get away with that. I think the biggest problem we have now is that once a body decides to limit comment, there's nothing you can do, you know, unless you go to court to sue. And so they know they have that power. And so I think the best solution to dealing dealing with that is to have a court recognize that there's a constitutional right, a First Amendment right to speak, not just a statutory allowance.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get that constitutional right, you're starting with a presumption that, of course, I have the right to speak. And then, yes, you work back to there must be some limits on that. But if you can start with the idea that the speaker has a right rather than the legislature, or the city council is giving you some gift, you know, I think that that starting point makes a big difference.
That makes sense. What are your predictions for a case like this? So FIRE has now taken up this case on First Amendment grounds for this woman in Surprise. Have you seen cases like that be successful?
I would think she would win on the point that she had a right to speak. But this is the difficult part. Once you are told you don't and someone is trying to escort you from a podium,
mm-hmm.
do you have a right to say, no, I'm not leaving, get your hands off me?
Mm.
We like to think of it as she was arrested for speaking, and that must be remedied by the court. But in a sense, she was told she had violated the rule that she had agreed to,
mm-hmm.
and then she was only arrested for not leaving the chamber where she didn't have a right to be. So that makes it tough. It really makes it a complicated question.
Mm-hmm.
But that itself is a complicated question, because if you're arrested in public for speaking and they say you're actually just trespassing, that can often, you know, you can prevail in court by saying, well, yeah, but they were doing that just to interfere with my rights.
Mm.
So that's the argument you have to make. And it's very possible she could prevail.
That's really interesting. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Greg Leslie, Executive Director of the First Amendment Clinic at ASU, joining us. Greg, thanks as always for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Lexi Lockett has been performing burlesque in Phoenix for a decade.
When I started burlesque, I had just experienced a major loss. And I was 23 when I started burlesque. And despite being a young, hot 23-year-old, I did not feel like it.
Yeah.
And so I was really trying to reclaim that and remind myself of I am youthful and people are attracted to me and all of these things.
Yeah. So there was an identity piece and ownership to you.
Totally.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, every month at Boycott Bar in Phoenix, she and a group of performers put on a show they call Hump Day Burlesque. They've been doing it since 2015, minus a COVID break. But it's not your average burlesque show.
I think the goal is always to be able to give people a positive experience. And sometimes that might be challenging what you find attractive or what you are intrigued by.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel it can definitely be a delicate line to walk, but no one's ever said anything directly.
I mean, but it sounds like you want to walk that line a little bit. Give us an example. What are some of the things on stage that people might see that be oh, that's not what I expected?
Oh, I mean, anytime someone brings out a staple gun.
What? Explain that one.
Yeah. People will do various acts exploring religious trauma or my best friend, who is one of the original performers and producers of Hump Day, Jacqueline Hyde, travels year round and has done an act. This was not on Hump Day stage, but
mm-hmm.
they live in North Carolina 2 months of the year. And there was some legislation that was happening that I think it was women's rights. And so they printed it out and was stapling it to their body.
Whoa. Wow.
Because, art.
Yes. But ow, that would hurt.
Yeah.
Every week there's a theme. Halloween is a big one. They started the year with a tarot card theme show. And July 3rd show was themed Art as Activism. But they do what's often called neo-burlesque, a subversive, countercultural approach to the craft. They're a diverse group, and they perform in a queer space. Boycott Bar is one of the last lesbian bars left in the country.
In our society, so much power comes from beauty and from what we find attractive. And so anytime we can challenge someone to expand what they include in that is really cool, because my perspective from little 23-year-old Lexi Lockett,
right.
who was just wow, this is so cool, to now has been so broadened and so widened.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you see someone on that stage just claiming their power and their confidence in whatever way it is being embodied in that moment is so cool.
Turns out they're part of a long history of burlesque performers who have worked against the dominant culture of the day. Kay Siebler is an English professor and gender studies scholar at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and 10 years ago she wrote a paper about neo-burlesque. It seemed relevant at the time, but she told me burlesque just keeps coming back, from Lady Marmalade to what's happening today. But it all started as far back as the 1860s, and a warning, this conversation may not be appropriate for all listeners.
So you think about the United States in the 1860s and the women's rights movement, mm-hmm. voting rights, property rights, divorce laws, all of those things are happening alongside abolitionist movements and the right to vote and all those things. That's when burlesque emerged. And in fact, burle, the Italian root of that word, is actually parody, satire, humor. And when it first emerged on the scene, it was a part of vaudeville routines. You think about pre-movie houses, the only entertainment that a lot of areas of the country had access to were these vaudeville touring groups.
Right.
A lot of them were owned by women, and Black women were able to have a livelihood that way, you know, depending on where they were traveling. But it was a very empowering thing that these women, these troupes of women did. And yes, they were dancing. And yes, a lot of times they were subverting sort of the Victorian ideology of what it meant to be sexy and a woman.
Right.
But it was edgy. And there was always an element of skit, satire, parody, humor. It was considered very political.
So it's about sexuality, but it's also about femininity and what that means.
You know, and even more than sexuality, and I would say it is the opposite of femininity. it is subverting everything that we are told is femininity in the patriarchy, because the patriarchy defines femininity. Women don't get to define femininity. The patriarchal culture defines femininity as an act of keeping women passive and disempowered. Because if you think of any feminine trait, it is typically one that does not garner cultural power. Be quiet, be passive, be ladylike, you know, that laden term of ladylike. And so the roots of burlesque were really more about defying femininity and reclaiming a power of what it meant to be woman, what it meant to be a performing woman outside of the constriction of the patriarchy at the moment.
So let me ask you about neo-burlesque and what makes it different, what makes it new.
So neo-burlesque is a term that is used by a lot of people simply to mean this new iteration of burlesque. Mm-hmm. But in fact, I would argue that neo-burlesque needs to have that feminist sort of subtext and the feminist sort of commentary regarding female sexuality. Otherwise, it's just burlesque in a very traditional, not in the way that I've just described burlesque and the history of burlesque, but right. in a traditional sense of burlesque as titillation for the male audience. And in fact, neo-burlesque reclaims that and says, guess what? The audience is not male. Or if it is male, I want to bring you to the point of you're like intrigued and titillated in a very sort of traditional patriarchal version of feminine sexuality. Mm-hmm. And then at that very moment, I am going to disrupt it and I'm going to make you uncomfortable. And I'm going to insert into this performance a commentary about what it means to be a woman in the patriarchy and what female sexuality means in the context of the patriarchy. Can we even imagine or understand what female sexuality would be outside of a patriarchal construct? Or is everything that we know about how we experience sexuality as females fed to us by the patriarchy for the end result of male sexual gratification?
So what does that look like? What's an example?
Right. So there's so many interesting things that go on in neo-burlesque. Neo-burlesque really started in, I want to say, the 1990s, and it was very queer. It was very New York, and it was very punk. So the Velvet Hammer was a burlesque troupe, a neo-burlesque troupe in New York City during the mid-1990s, and they were punk women. And if you know anything about the history of punk, punk was very much a queer feminist music movement at that period of time, again, reclaiming music, the power of women reclaiming music. And they, the Velvet Hammer, started these burlesque shows where it was very much calling on a vision of female sexuality that was drawing on punk. So very powerful, very, I don't want to say like loud, but loud in every version that you can think about that, and rejecting all these patriarchal norms of passive vessel of female sexuality. But fast forward, it's very queer. It's very much feminist. So I saw a burlesque performance where someone was doing the typical burlesque, and underneath was black Sharpie sort of defining her body into like slabs of meat. I've seen neo-burlesque where a woman came out in this lovely sort of froofy bride outfit, right? And she's taking off her bride outfit while Tammy Wynette's D-I-V-O-R-C-E is, you know, she's dancing to that, right?
So I get it. Again, yeah.
You're getting to the point where you're making a commentary about what it means to be a sexual woman and what that means within just the culture that is the patriarchy, calling people to think about that.
Does this also have to do with inclusion, like with women of color, with queer bodies, right, with fat bodies, right?
Yes, yes. So going back again to that history, and we're talking about Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, women, black women who were on that vaudeville circuit, many of them lesbians, many of them women loving women, saying we're playing with this sexuality. We're throwing it in your face. This is our sexuality. And so fast forward to neo-burlesque today, larger bodies, black and brown bodies, not the sort of Dita Von Teese who's so white, she looks like she's alabaster, you know, doing her burlesque dance in the martini glass.
Let me ask you, Kay, I mean, like, so what do you think is happening in our culture right now that might be bringing back, you know, burlesque in this way that it ebbs and flows? Like, you know, you wrote this paper 10 years ago and it was kind of a big thing. Then we're seeing it here now. Like, what do you think is happening that sparks this again?
We see these moments of those outside, those traditionally outside the systems of power going, no, we've had enough. We're pushing back against this because what we're looking at is a landscape in which all we have is stuff that we're losing.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Kay Siebler, an English professor and gender studies scholar at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, joining us to talk all about burlesque and neo-burlesque. Kay, thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Luis Carlos Bernal was a pioneering Chicano photographer who dedicated much of his career to chronicling the lives of Mexican Americans in Tucson and the Southwest. He photographed everyday people in the barrios, often in their homes, in an attempt to create a vibrant and authentic record of life in his community. Bernal's work is the subject of a new exhibition at the U of A's Center for Creative Photography, which opens this weekend. It's called Retrospectiva, and curator Elizabeth Ferrer has been working on it for decades. When she spoke with the show's Sam Dingman recently, she began by describing one of Bernal's iconic images, a photograph called Dos Mujeres.
Dos Mujeres is a portrait of two young women, one who is sitting in a house in the foreground and the other in the background in a bedroom. They sit in really distinct spaces. The young woman is on a chair, seems like she's sewing a dress. In the background is this rich forest green wall and a calendar. And then the woman in the background is in a room that is painted this brilliant red. And she's sitting on a bed. Right next to her is a window. And the light just streams in. And it beautifully illuminates both of their faces. So I think it's really a psychologically telling picture. We don't know really anything about the two women. You know, we assume that they live together. We don't know what their relationship is. You know, he was able to gain their trust, and they just look at us very openly, and we really gain a sense of their spirit.
Yeah. Thank you for that really lovely description. And I think it could be a nice jumping off point for us to talk about some of the hallmarks of his work. One of them is his relationship with his subjects, which I've seen described as, quote, collaborative acquiescence.
Yes.
How would you explain that?
Well, when he arrived in Tucson in 1973 and he started wandering around the barrios, you know, he had become very involved in his identity as a Chicano, and he had decided that he wanted to capture ways of life that were quickly disappearing in the Tucson barrios. And, you know, so he literally went around with his camera, meeting people. He was fluent in Spanish. He wasn't capturing protest marches or anything like that. He wanted to capture everyday people in the environments which they were most familiar with, you know, their homes. You know, where he photographed not only the people, but the photographs that they had on their wall, in some cases the altars that they had in corners of a room. And this collaborative acquiescence, I think, has to do with the fact that he would, you know, occasionally arrange, you know, windows or doors. He would ask people where to sit. You know, he was able to, I would say, you know, quietly direct the action so that he could make these very telling portraits.
Yes, well, this focus on composition as well as relationships with his subjects makes me think about his focus on the kind of artifacts and ephemera that people keep in their living space. You mentioned in describing Dos Mujeres, the calendar that's on the wall behind the young woman in the foreground of the image. What do you make of his fixation, not just on the people, but on the objects that they keep in their homes?
Well, a friend of his once told me that when he would go into these houses with these altars, he could be very emotional about that. You know, he was raised a Catholic, although he was not practicing Catholic, but he knew what all that meant. You know, he knew what that meant culturally and spiritually. And he knew what the family photos meant. You know, these are pictures that would tie people across, you know, generations and across geographies. You know, often they were pictures of ancestors from Mexico. Especially later in his career, he would often photograph the interiors without the people. And I think those are also portraits.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting because you were just talking about his inner life and his inner spiritual life. And it makes me think of a quote of his that I found very compelling that I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about. He said, quote, "I have felt a great deal of anger and anxiety in my life, and I have used photography as an outlet for those frustrations. My images have always dealt with the inner battle of my soul."
When I found that quote, it surprised me. Although when I spoke to people who knew him, they did tell me about the frustrations that he faced. He was such a good photographer, and he knew it. But he was not getting the kinds of recognition that white photographers were getting at that time. You know, especially, you know, say in the 1970s, this was the era when a lot of his colleagues were having museum exhibitions, were having gallery exhibitions, were selling their work, were making limited edition prints of their work because they could sell it. You know, Bernal did have success on many levels. He was well known in the Chicano community. He was well known throughout the Southwest. He was speaking at a lot of conferences. He had exhibitions in nonprofit spaces, but he wasn't having that level of success. And he was always facing the challenge of wanting to do these ambitious projects without the budget. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those kinds of things did frustrate him. And late in his life, he actually talked about leaving photography. And yet, you know, he kept making the work. He kept at it until the very end.
Well, how much of that inability to break through commercially or in terms of renown has to do with the fact that it seems to me that he always had a sort of cautious relationship with the political valence of his work, never seeming to quite want to overtly embrace his work as activist art, but also being in dialogue with and aware of the political messaging that it could convey to some viewers.
You know, at that time, there were very few Chicano photographers or, you know, Latinx photographers more generally. Later in the 80s and in the 90s, there was kind of an explosion of interest in Latino art. And then it sort of ebbed. And in the last few years, it sort of exploded again. But that just wasn't happening at the time. You know, he is the father of Chicano photography. We often call him that. And, he was almost just a little too early for that kind of recognition, unfortunately.
That makes me think of this word that he used to describe his whole attitude towards life, which was Chicanismo. Can you tell us what he meant by that?
So Bernal really became involved with the Chicano cultural movement in graduate school, so the early 70s. And, you know, at that time, and well, you'll see it in the exhibition, he was doing some pretty experimental work. For a couple of years, he was working under Frederick Summer, who was this, you know, very well-known avant-garde photographer who was based near Tucson. And, you know, he could have gone in that direction. He could have gone in this more artistic direction, and maybe he would have become better known that way. But when he decided to go to the Tucson Barrios to work among his own people, this is where the idea of Chicanismo is just so profound for Bernal. He becomes increasingly proud of his identity as a Chicano, and he wants to express that through his art. And that word art is very important, you know, not through documentation, but through art. And so, you know, again, going back to what I said earlier, this idea of, you know, working with documentation and stage photography and directing, you know, he wanted to portray the people that he came across in the best way possible. He wanted to express their dignity, their resilience. He wanted to show them as people that were worthy of attention, you know, people that might have otherwise, you know, passed, you know, in a more anonymous way. You know, Bernal memorializes them. You know, he makes these faces something that we can't forget.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth Ferrer is the curator of Luis Carlos Bernal Retrospectiva at the Center for Creative Photography in Tucson. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Today is, of course, the 23rd anniversary of the terrorist attacks of 9/11, and people are gathering across the country to remember it. Here in the Valley, you can visit the Tempe Healing Field, which memorializes each life lost that day with a flag planted in the ground at Tempe Beach Park. In Scottsdale, you can join in a 9/11 memorial stair climb at Salt River Fields by climbing the equivalent of 110 stories of the World Trade Center. And on Saturday, the Travis Mannion Foundation will host the Phoenix 9/11 Heroes Run to honor the first responders of 9/11 and the service members who served in the wars that came after.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.